For the Love of a Dog, Understanding Emotion in You and Your Best Friend, by Patricia B. McConnell, Ph.D. Narrated by Ellen Archer. Copyright 2006 by Patricia B. McConnell, Ph.D. This unabridged audiobook is published by arrangement with Patricia McConnell and Zachary Schuster Harmsworth and was produced in the year 2006 by Tantor Media Incorporated, which holds the copyright thereto. Note from the author. The stories in this book are all true, although I have changed the names of all my clients and most of their dogs in order to protect their privacy. I doubt that the dogs would care if they knew you were reading about them, but I can't ask them, so I've covered my bases and changed their names. I kept the names of my own dogs. That's what they get for living with a writer. Although I've changed the names of individual dogs in the book, I have chosen to identify them by breed, even when the story included a dog causing serious injury. I realize that might result in some criticism. No one wants to hear about an individual of a breed they love causing serious harm. Two of the breeds I mention are Rottweilers and Pit Bulls. Because of the negative publicity those breeds tend to attract, I thought long and hard about changing their breed designation in the case stories recounted within the book. But then, changing to another breed would anger lovers of whatever breed I chose. I considered changing all the dogs to mixed breeds or never mentioning breed at all, but that seemed dishonest and contrived. I finally decided that the best thing to do was to simply recount what happened, the way it happened. However, I don't want the stories in this book to add to stereotypes of those breeds, any more than I want people to believe that Labradors and Border Collies are dangerous dogs just because there are stories in the book about ones who have caused serious injuries. As readers will see, I adore Border Collies, but a problematic one can be a nightmare. The truth of the matter is that dogs who can open their mouths can bite, and big, strong dogs are more dangerous than little ones. And most important, a tragically large number of dogs are being bred and raised by people in this country for all the wrong reasons. On another note, some progressive readers will notice that I have not used the term guardian for those of us who live with and love domestic dogs. I have chosen to use the more traditional term, owner, although I understand that the choice can be interpreted in different ways. I'm the first to admit that owner is not a perfect description of who we are to our dogs, but being perhaps too old and set in my ways, I find the term guardian a bit awkward. I'm working on it, but I just can't make it feel right yet. It feels formal and lawyerly, and somehow less intimate than my relationship is with my dogs. Lacking a better alternative, I have used the term owner throughout the book. Of course, the term owner itself can also be off-putting. One would never talk about being a child's owner, after all. But all words can have different meanings, different connotations, and when I say owner, I mean simply that they are my dogs and I'm responsible for them. I'm reminded of a woman who introduced her significant other thus. This is John. My John. My dogs are just that, my dogs. They are also my friends and my co-workers, and I have the deepest respect for them. Readers should also be aware that the term behaviorist, used frequently in this book, has many different meanings. Applied animal behaviorists are people like me who use their academic background and behavior to solve problems and issues related to non-human animals. These issues can vary from working with aggressive dogs to enhancing the habitat of animals in zoological parks to saving endangered species. Our academic background, however, can vary. My Ph.D. major was in zoology, in which I was trained as an ethologist, or someone most interested in how animals' behavior interacts with its genetic heritage and its environment. My minor was in psychology, where historically the focus was on how an animal's behavior is influenced by learning, and on discovering how the process of learning works in both animals and people. This is the source of the other use of the term behaviorist, which refers to a perspective that endorses, a la B.F. Skinner, giving scientific attention only to an animal's external behavior. Animals' internal processes, such as thoughts and emotions, were believed to be inaccessible to scientific inquiry. To the benefit of all, both fields are now integrated to a large degree. The term behaviorist is used in both senses in the text of this book, I hope in a way that keeps its meaning clear to the reader. I have also chosen to put references to most of the research described in the book in the references section, rather than in the body of the text. I hope the authors of the papers I mentioned do not take offense. Books like this could never be written without the hours and hours of hard work put in every week by scientists of all descriptions. My goal in writing this and other books is to provide a bridge between the knowledge derived from their work and the general dog-loving public. Moving the citations to the back allows for a freer flow of narrative and, I hope, results in a book that keeps the interest of all dog lovers, even if they didn't love science class in high school. And finally, if your or your dog's emotions are causing behavioral problems, don't hesitate to seek professional advice. Even the best tennis player in the world has a coach, and dog training is a sport as much as anything else. Introduction. Tulip broke away from me as we approached the body of a ewe named Harriet and sniffed her from head to hoof. Harriet's death was a significant event on my little farm. Until the very end, even at the ancient age of 14, Harriet was a remarkable individual. In her youth, her delicate bone structure and toffee-colored wool qualified her for supermodel status. In old age, she was little more than a scraggly skeleton, but even when fed a liquid diet through a turkey baster, she managed a sense of dignity that elicited respect from sheep, humans, and dogs alike. I was fonder of Harriet than any of the sheep I've ever had, and I'd already cried like a baby by the time Tulip and I walked down to visit her body, lying cold and stiff in the grass. Tulip, my Great Pyrenees sheep-guarding dog, hadn't been in the barn when the veterinarian put Harriet down. I'd put Tulip in the house so that the vet could end Harriet's life with no distractions. It's Tulip's job to protect the sheep from the coyotes and stray dogs that flow throughout the Wisconsin countryside. Tulip's commitment to nonviolence is impressive, but she can be counted on to protect her sheep when they need her. Normally docile, Tulip can switch from gentle nanny to Xena warrior dog in a microsecond. Although she's never hurt a person, dog, or sheep in 10 years of guarding my farm, she's roared in like a freight train when a 300-pound ram attacked me, when a visiting dog tore into one of my own, and when a foolish border collie switched from herding sheep to hunting them in the excitement of youth. She's also playful and curious, so it seemed wise to let the vet do his work without her. Because of that, Tulip hadn't seen Harriet pass from life to death, and when she found Harriet's body lying in the grass, she seemed profoundly affected by it. She sniffed Harriet's body, circling, sniffing, and repeatedly nudging her. After a few minutes, she lay down beside the body. She placed her big white muzzle on her paws, sighed once, a long, slow exhalation of what we'd call resignation in a human, and then refused to move. She growled at the approach of my border collies. They withdrew and came over to sit beside me, about 25 feet away. I don't remember how long Tulip lay beside Harriet, but she wouldn't leave her voluntarily. Finally, a darkness softened the sky. I gently took her by the collar and walked her back to the house. Tulip looked for all the world as if she knew that Harriet had died, and she looked as sad about it as I felt. There's only one catch. She behaves in similar ways to pigeons she's killed herself, and last week to an ear of corn I'd given her to chew. While my three border collies munched away on their own corn cobs, milky yellow juice running down their chins, Tulip carried hers with great gravity over to her favorite spot, gently and carefully placed it between her paws, and proceeded to guard it from all comers. She didn't chew it, she didn't lick it, she just lay beside it, her face quiet and grave, just as she lay beside Harriet's body that sad morning at Red Start Farm. I want it to be true that Tulip's behavior around Harriet was an expression of something more meaningful than her demeanor around an ear of corn. A respectful awareness of Harriet's life fits into my belief about who Tulip is, and, more importantly, who I want her to be. Perhaps it is meaningful that Tulip's behavior toward Harriet was not exactly the same as her behavior toward dead pigeons or corn cobs. She never put her head down on her paws with food, as she did beside Harriet, and she never sighed a great gulping sigh when looming over a dead pigeon. I find it hard to believe that my big-eyed, soulful dog had the same response to Harriet's dead body as she did to a vegetable. But the truth of the matter is, I don't know what was in Tulip's head as she lay beside Harriet's body. Did she know that Harriet was dead and understand what that meant for the future? I want to know what was going on in her mind that quiet summer evening after Harriet died, but how can I find the way into her head? For that matter, what can any of us know about the emotional life of any of our dogs? It's hard enough to know what's going on in the mind of another person, much less an individual of another species. But we want to know. Understanding what someone else is experiencing is the key to feeling connected, and feeling connected is an integral part of any good relationship. Penny for your thoughts is more than an old-fashioned phrase. It's an expression of our desire to understand the thoughts and emotions of those we love. We humans are social animals, and our desire for connection is deep and relentless. Those of us who love our dogs deeply, who consider our dogs friends and family, want to know what's going on in their minds as much as we do in our relationships with other people. We don't need to think of our dogs as furry little people to want to understand how their emotional life compares with ours. I and many others don't want to live with fuzzy, nonverbal humans who walk on four legs but roll in cow pies. We like it that our dogs are dogs. The differences between us enrich our relationships and increase our sense of connection to the world around us. But the genetic gap between us means it's even harder to know what our dogs are thinking and feeling than it is with our human friends. No wonder animal communicators who claim access to the minds of our companion animals have become so popular. Sometimes, even without the benefit of language, we make deep connections to the dogs in our lives. Other times, just as in any relationship, things may not go so well. I'll never forget a dog, one of those special ones with penetrating eyes, who simply stopped looking at her owner. I watched the two of them for several hours at a herding clinic, a petite gray-haired woman with a tidy black-and-white border collie on a bright red leash. The dog looked everywhere but toward the woman who loved her, at one point sitting silently at the woman's side for almost an hour, with her head turned 180 degrees away. The woman who owned and loved the dog was well-intentioned, but her words and movements were all so confusing that even I had no idea what she was trying to communicate. I didn't have the slightest idea of what she was trying to get her dog to do, much less what she was thinking. I suspect the smart, willing little dog found her owner so frustrating that she could no longer bear to make the attempt to communicate, and so she spent her time avoiding making any connection at all. I was reminded of the times I've turned off my car radio because even though I could still make out some of the words, the static was so aversive I couldn't stand listening. I found the mismatch so heartbreaking that at the end of the day, I asked the woman whether I could buy her dog. I wasn't surprised when she said no, because she seemed to love the dog dearly, and you can't exactly walk up to a stranger and tell them that they're inadvertently torturing their dog and expect them to thank you and then hand over the leash. But I can still see the dog's sweet, honest face, and I wonder if she's still alive, looking off into space, turning off the static as best she can. Most of us do a better job of bridging the gap between our minds and the minds of our dogs than the woman described above, but that doesn't mean it's not a struggle. We may think we know how our dog is feeling, but that doesn't mean we're right. We may be sure we know what's going on inside the heart and mind of our mother or son or partner, but the truth is, we're often mistaken. Psychologists tell us that erroneous assumptions about what others are thinking and feeling cause no end of problems in human interactions. We don't even know what's going on in our own minds half the time. As we'll see later, much of our behavior is influenced by processes outside our conscious awareness. No wonder figuring out what's going on in the mind of your dog is a challenge. Even though getting into our dog's heads isn't easy, we're not utterly clueless.
For a start, we are making tremendous strides in understanding how human brains work. We may like to talk about the heart as the seat of emotions, but it's the brain that lies at the center of our feelings. If we want to understand our feelings, we have to start by understanding our brain. Our emotional life begins and ends in our brains, and the more we understand how this amazing mix of neurons, hormones, and electricity works, the better we'll understand emotions. Right now, there are legions of researchers working on the brain, riding a rising tide of scientific and popular interest in the mind and how it functions. Much of that interest and attention has been driven by the amazing new technologies that allow us to watch the brain as it works. One of the most useful of the new technologies, the fMRI, allows us to see which areas of the brain are active while the brain is working. You can show people pictures, ask them questions, or inject hormones into their bodies and learn which parts of the brain are engaged while they are sorting things out. Studies like this have taught us, for example, that most people have a particularly sophisticated area of the brain designated to recognize faces, while a less powerful area is programmed to recognize objects. Autistic people, on the other hand, use the object recognition part of their brains when looking at faces. No wonder they have so much trouble reading emotional expressions on the faces around them. Neuroscience may be exciting, but it's not for the faint of heart, or for that matter, the weak of mind. Brains are absurdly complicated things, and understanding the role that they play in our emotional life is no small challenge. Just the language used to describe the structure and function of the brain is, well, elaborate. In his wonderful book, A User's Guide to the Brain, John J. Rady says that after the brain itself, the second most complex object in the universe is the body of language we use to talk about the brain. How true that is! I howled when I read it, having started the daunting process of wading through articles on, for example, the role of the anterior cingulate gyrus in idiomotor apraxia. As luck would have it, more and more books are being written by neuroscientists for those of us who aren't in their field but who are interested in how our brains affect our behavior. Whether you're interested in why you left the house intending to buy a beagle puppy but instead brought home a Jack Russell Terrier, or why you still cry over your golden retriever who died 10 years ago, these books can help you bridge the gap between the dual but related mysteries of brain and behavior. Books like Descartes' Error, Emotion, Reason, and the Human Brain by Antonio Damasio, and Biology of the Mind by Derek Bounds allow us non-neuroscientists to share in the fun. Our focus on mental processes may have been encouraged by new technologies, but interest in the workings of our own brains isn't new. However, our interest in the minds of non-human animals has waxed and waned over the centuries. 30 years ago, at least in this country, scientific interest in the minds of animals was barely perceptible. At the moment, it's increasing by leaps and bounds. One of the most interesting results of that research is the realization that thoughts and emotions can't be separated from each other as neatly as we once believed. Justifiably proud of our own intellectual abilities, we've paid most of our attention to the thinking, problem-solving part of our mind, comparing it, favorably of course, with the brains of other animals. However, new ways of studying the brain have resulted in an expanding focus on emotions, what they are, how they are generated, and what their purpose might be. Not only are we starting to understand what emotions actually are, we're starting to understand their importance in humans and animals alike. This increased interest in the inner lives of animals is a wonderful thing for dog lovers because the burgeoning interest in the mental experiences of animals has resulted in a parallel interest in the minds of our dogs. Dogs are finally getting some of the attention they deserve, having been proof for decades of the saying, "Familiarity breeds contempt." Scientists could study right whales or Serengeti lions or scissor-tailed flycatchers, but heaven forbid you tried to make your name as a researcher studying dogs. However, that has changed in just the last few years, and lately there have been articles in prestigious scientific journals, from the Journal of Comparative Psychology to Science, that add to our knowledge about the cognitive abilities of dogs. That interest has been reflected in a group of thoughtful books written specifically about the intellectual abilities of the dog. For example, How Dogs Think by Stanley Coren. If Dogs Could Talk by Vilmos Cezanne and The Truth About Dogs by Stephen Budiansky act as welcome bridges between what people want to know about the minds of their dogs and what science has actually discovered. Our dogs may not be lying around pondering the evolution of emotion and whether their humans experience emotions the same way they do, but it's the most natural thing in the world for us to wonder about the emotions of our dogs. How could we not? We've called dogs our best friends for centuries, and what is more basic to friendship than an emotional connection? A friendship with no emotional component is no friendship at all. It's a business arrangement, and even those usually have their share of emotional loading attached. Our dogs evoke a veritable sea of emotions in us, and we ride the waves back and forth between love and joy and sadness and anger almost on a daily basis. For centuries, dog lovers have believed that we're not paddling by ourselves. Surely our dogs are out there with us, experiencing emotions similar to our own. Who could watch puppies play or observe dogs lying motionless for days after losing a good friend and not believe that our dogs have emotions as we do? In contrast to the beliefs of most dog lovers, current beliefs among scientists and philosophers about the emotional life of dogs are all over the map. Some argue that only humans can experience emotions, while others argue that non-human animals experience primitive emotions like fear and anger, but not more complicated ones like love and pride. At the other end of the continuum, some say it's good science to believe that many mammals come with the whole package, being capable of experiencing emotions in ways comparable to the way we experience them. The fact is, we don't know enough yet to be sure exactly what's going on inside the minds of our dogs, but we know enough to consider the topic thoughtfully, and we know enough to stop and look around at what we do know, what we don't know, and what we still want to learn. That's what this book is about. It's an inquiry into the emotions of dogs and of the people who love them. It is written in the belief that the issue is both gloriously simple and painstakingly complex. On the other hand, of course dogs have emotions. It seems so patently obvious to most of us that we feel foolish at having to say it. As much as any animal on earth, dogs express emotions as purely and clearly as a 5-year-old child, and surely that's part of why we love them so much. And yet, once that's acknowledged, things quickly get more complicated. Emotions are amazingly complex, and, as is often the case, the more we know, the more complicated things get. As our knowledge of the brain deepens, we're starting to understand that emotions are vital parts of our conscious and unconscious lives, integrally involved in our ability to make good, or bad, decisions. While we've historically considered rational thought to be superior to our emotions, it turns out that rational thought, uninformed by emotion, can cause us no end of trouble. Trouble, the kind between people and dogs, is one of the reasons I'm interested in this topic. I'm a certified applied animal behaviorist who has worked with dogs with serious behavioral problems for 17 years. Part of my job is to try to get into the heads of dogs whose behavior is problematic. Most of what motivates people to come to my office involves canine aggression, dogs who snarl when you take them by the collar, or who bite the neighbor, or who start fights at the dog park. Other people come because their dogs panic when they leave the house, or leap through the plate glass window when it thunders. All these problems, I will argue, are influenced by emotions, by fear, by happiness, or by anger born of frustration. It's important for me to know what emotions are involved, not just to help the dog and his owner, but to keep myself safe in a small room with a dog who bites people. Contrary to the belief of some, behaviorists, trainers, and veterinarians don't come with a shield that protects us from being bitten. I don't know how many times I've heard, "Oh my, usually he would have bitten you by now," from an owner whose prediction that their dog was going to bite didn't result in any preventative steps on their part. But those of us who work with aggressive dogs usually don't get bitten because we've learned to read dogs and can make guesses about their emotions and motivations. Those guesses help us predict what a dog is about to do next and how to respond, like a good dance partner, in a way that helps us both. Of course, observing that a dog looks fearful doesn't mean we understand how much of her experience of fear is like our own. But professionally, it matters that the outside of a dog can tell me something about the inside of a dog. That allows me to design a treatment plan that takes the personality of the dog into account, rather than provide a cookie-cutter approach straight out of a textbook. And even if it weren't useful, the fact of the matter is, I simply want to know what it's like to be a dog. As Jeffrey Musef's Masson said in Dogs Never Lie About Love, I know them as well as I know my closest friend, and yet I have no idea who they are. What an exquisite paradox. It sends shivers up my spine. I want to know more about what dogs are feeling and how those feelings compare with mine. I want to know because I was trained as a scientist and am driven by the drug-like excitement of discovery. I want to know because I think it's important for our species to understand where we fit in with the rest of life. In addition, so much suffering in both species could be prevented if we had a better understanding of the emotional lives of our dogs. But most of all, I want to know because of my own dogs. My dogs are as important to me as my human friends. They are my buddies, my family, my co-workers, my therapists, and, like all good friends, occasionally thorns in my side. I want to know more about who they are and what they are feeling, partly from a desire to give them the best life I can, and partly from a desire to deepen our friendship. I have 3 dogs now. 3 dogs and a gravestone in the pasture for my soulmate dog, Cool Hand Luke, who died recently and still seems as much a part of the farm as I am. His daughter, 12-year-old Lassie, is always at my side, a hard-working border collie who works with the sheep, helps with dog-dog aggression cases, and joins me in public appearances. Lassie is buttery soft, as responsive as a race car, and I think worried much of the time. 15-year-old Pip is also a border collie, but she's the one who didn't read the book about how border collies are supposed to behave. Quiet and docile, even as a puppy, Pip wags her tail to stubborn sheep and turns in terror if a ewe so much as turns and looks at her. Pip was always the quiet one, the nanny dog, the dog you could count on to stay at home and take care of the kids while the rest of you went out to play. A spirit guide to fearfully aggressive dogs, Pippi loved other dogs and men with equal devotion, and I've always wondered whether, if she had the choice of families, she would have chosen a home with a quiet, single man. Pip looks like a border collie crossed with a Labrador, complete with the sweet, goofy expression typical of retrievers on the outside, and a mind like a steel trap on the inside. Pip can learn a new trick in a session or two, while it takes Lassie days or weeks to figure it out. At 15, Pip is old now. She can't hear very well, and she follows me everywhere, breaking my heart when she stands watching out the window as I drive away on business trips. And then there's Tulip, my 11-year-old Great Pyrenees, the poster child for dogs as emotional beings. She radiates joy like the sun shining on a winter's day. Tulip is a huge, fluffy, leap-spinning playground unto herself, and I love her so much, I can feel it in my chest just writing about it. And that's what it's all about, isn't it? Our connection with dogs is based on emotion, on the joy they give us, the love we feel for them and from them. If we're honest, it also includes the anger and hurt we experience when we feel betrayed by them, and the fear they engender when they flash their teeth or bite our faces. Dogs evoke emotions in us as if wringing water out of a sponge, and so discussions about whether they have emotions themselves seem like arguments about whether there's a sun in the sky. But for all the love that we have for dogs, for all the joy and the tears, we have a lot to learn about our own emotions around them and their emotional responses to us. Love, as any partner or parent can tell you, isn't the same as understanding. Like the woman who loved her border collie as much as she confused her, we all can profit from learning more about emotions in both species. Some people who love their dogs are oblivious to blatant expressions of emotions on the dogs' faces. Just ask any dog trainer. Others, not very good at controlling their own emotions around dogs, cause, at best, confusion. At worst, terrible suffering. Many dog owners don't know that dogs, like kids, need to learn to control their own emotions. I've seen countless dogs who bit someone out of what I think was frustration, lashing out in an emotional outburst that could have been prevented if they'd learned what all individuals who live with others need to learn, that patience is a virtue. Many emotions support or undermine our relationship with dogs, but fear stands alone as the single most common cause of serious behavior problems in dogs. Dogs destroy the house because they're afraid of being alone, or tremble in the closet because they're thunderphobic, or cower when the neighbor kids come over to play, and end up lashing out when the children trap them in a corner. Many people don't realize how often dog bites are motivated by fear, or how yelling at them only increases their fear, making them more likely to bite again. My hope is that this book, besides being intellectually interesting, will prevent some of those bites and decrease some of the suffering that occurs when individuals love each other without the understanding necessary to keep the relationship healthy. For the Love of a Dog is a combination of stories, science, and practical advice about how understanding emotions in both people and dogs can improve your relationship with your dog. It's not a dog training book, but it's full of information that can help your dog be better behaved and help you to be a better handler. It doesn't begin to discuss everything we know about the biology of emotions. That book would be too heavy to pick up. I focused on the emotions I think are most relevant in dog-human relationships: fear, anger, joy, and joy's cousin, love. My goal is to be both interesting and helpful to those of us who are, quite simply, crazy in love with our dogs. I wrote this book as much for dogs as I did for us, in the hopes it will, albeit indirectly, help dogs to better understand us, surely the world's most confusing species.